This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box, right here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. We are your podcast source for deep discussion of genre films, new and old. And I am one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where last week, since we didn't have a show last week, I'm telling you this week, I reviewed the Disney live-action feature, The Rocketeer. And, you know, it took me 26 years to catch this movie for the first time. I was not disappointed. But you can check the review right now at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week I'll be reviewing the musical, action, comedy, The Blues Brothers. Good old Blues Brothers. It's also the home of What Am I Watching This Week?, where I robbed Netflix of $10 from their bottom line because they suck. And I run through Amazon Prime's movie catalog, where we find stuff like Congo. Congo's on there. The Swedish horror film Evil Ed, which I'd never seen before, and I've heard things about. And you can find it on Amazon Prime. And I also found the Gumby movie, the much-forgotten Gumby movie that came out in 1995. And it was 30 years too late at that point as well. Joining
Gumby
me
will never die.
Gumby is a major contributor to the animated world, Joel. We both know that. We recognize that. Hopefully other people will too. Joining me as always, you heard him, is a man who scoffs at the idea of calling into work sick with the mumps. He's the Ayatollah of pop culture. The Iron Man, Joel LaPuma.
And thank you for that, Chris. I mean, I hate to just put myself over Roman Reigns like that, but am I cooler than Roman Reigns? Probably.
Yeah, without
question. Fewer people hate me, I can say that legitimately.
Yeah, you don't get booed when you show up to your place of work.
Well, you know, let's qualify that. I sometimes get booed. But no, you can find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And, you know, soon we're going to have some more paperback covers for you. Now that the month is calming down for all of us, it's been constant, like, film events and autograph signings and all sorts of nerd culture stuff.
You've been a busy little nerd there, Joel.
And just turned 31 and got to meet Jack Shoulder for my trouble.
No, that's pretty awesome.
Which was amazing.
Yeah. Cool. And love the website. Check out. I love the original paperback, and I can't wait to see more. So, you and Roxy have quite the rapport. No surprise.
And have you seen? I believe it's paperbacks from Hell, the recently released book on 70s and 80s horror fiction.
I have not seen that. That seems interesting, though.
Yeah, I've been meaning to pick off a copy. They did a sort of book release for it in Philadelphia at the International House, but it was sold out before I could get tickets for it, which is a shame because this feels, I mean, phenomenal. If you have any interest in cheesy, you know, lurid, gross horror paperbacks like I do, this seems like an absolutely perfect book.
So is it in the same vein as your piece where there's some humor around the covers, or is it just more of like a like a historical display sort of deal?
I think there's a lot of history of the movement, how it became, how that era in publishing made those books popular. But I think there is a lot of humor about the covers, about the plot synopses. You know, it's definitely not an overly serious book from all the excerpts I read, which is great because these books are, you know, amazing, and they're gross and strange, and you know, they're just everything you could possibly. They're trashy, absolute perfect trash.
Sounds like my kind of deal.
Mine too.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to check that out. Thanks for that heads up there, Joel. One thing I want to touch base on before we get started, of course, is this week we lost a kind of like a inspirational figure in the world of Italian cinema. Whether it's a giallo or a good old raunchy, gross cannibal film. Umberto Lenzi, who was the subject of our very first episode of this podcast, Joel, passed away this past week. And yeah.
It's been quite... it's been a rough couple of years for classic horror directors. I mean, we've lost so many. I mean, which is a shame because right now is such like a rebound of the horror genre, like at least especially in cinema, but even on the indie scene, on the straight to video scene, like horror films are probably the most like, you know, proportionally profitable segment of the film marketplace in America. And you know, all these great masters of the genre are, you know, dying just as there's a chance to like have renewed interest in their work. It's an unfortunate, you know, confluence of events.
Yeah, and of course, when we discussed Lindsay on the show, we mainly discussed his film Cannibal Ferox and a few of his other films. So, yeah, definitely, if you want to revisit that podcast, it is available online. You can probably find a link to it at RetroMovieNerd.com, where I have cataloged all of our podcasts. And so the Lenzi one was definitely an interesting work, considering we were both new to the whole game. And so we probably, whatever kinks we had in the show at that time, I'm sure we've worked them out since then. So
I don't think it was too bad, although a friend of mine who listened to it did say it was like a lecture in film history. I think we've gotten a lot less structured since then.
Excellent. Well, I'll take that as a compliment. You know. So let's move ahead then. Rest in peace, Umberto Lenzi. We're going to move on to the new release section. We got to hit on a few that came out last week first. October the 17th was the release date for these. Of course, the big one, new film, was from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, was Spider-Man Homecoming. And, of course, Joel, you and I have both gone on record as not having seen this just yet. I don't know. Myself, it's just an opportunity to sit down and watch it. Once Sam Raimi jumped off board, I guess you lost interest, huh?
Well, it was more that I just got sick of superhero movies. This one I'm probably going to see at some point because I love Michael Keaton. Like, I yield to no one in my love of Michael Keaton. It looks like an interesting film that's really trying to do something different than all the movies around it. Also, I'm a huge Zendaya fan. I also yield to no one in my love of her. So I will probably see this one at some point, which is more than I could say for most Marvel movies because I'm sick of the very Joss Whedon bantery thing, which this film seems to do a bit less of.
Okay.
They seem to be going for more of like just a traditional coming of age approach with it, with a lot of just very down-to-earth stuff. Like, I love the Vulture's backstory, that he's just an independent, like, contractor who's lost all these government contracts to clean up New York in the wake of everything the Avengers do to destroy it regularly.
Yeah.
Like, it's very much a angry working man takes revenge kind of narrative, which is a really interesting, clever way to go with this. It's not, you know, generic doomsday villain again.
No, actually, yeah, there's more of a modern take on a villain where he's just, you know, just an average guy who feels wronged and, you know, basically, I've heard good things about the Keaton role in this film, and yeah, it's definitely one when I take the opportunity to sit down and watch it, I'm probably going to enjoy it. I've heard it's hyperbole at this point, but, you know, you hear from people saying this is probably the strongest film in the Marvel Universe. I have doubts about that until I actually see it, but, you know, like I said, that's usually par for the course when, you know, these movies keep getting added to said universe.
Yeah, I think the fact that it seems like it's really trying to be its own film and not trying to sell you on 15 different sequels or future installments probably does legitimately make it one of the strongest releases they've done in a while.
Yeah. Until we see how they do with Black Panther, you know?
Which, yeah, there's an opportunity to do something interesting there. I mean, Black Panther's got some interesting there's some interesting stories in his back catalog. Like, yeah, they could. And, you know, one of the most famous Black Panther runs was written by Reginald Hudlin, who is the man who gave us one of the greatest films of all time, House Party.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Unfortunately, that run, I've read it, it's good, it doesn't read like House Party, so, you know, I could have used more kid in play, but...
It was snubbed at the Oscars that year as well, so we're all a little bit bitter about that.
We are, yeah. We are.
Well, let's move on to some older films that were released on Blu-ray last week, October 17th. This one from, the next three we're going to talk about all came from Kino Classics. They hit them out of the park last week, Joel.
Oh, yeah, they're really rolling.
Oh, yeah, so the first one I want to talk about, and this one just sounds awesome. I have not seen it, but I want to. Just writing up the description of this movie just made me drool. From 1987, Rolling Vengeance. And basically, a man builds the ultimate monster truck to take revenge on some drunk guys that killed his family. You got Ned Beatty in it as the lead drunk guy. this truck, I mean, the guy tricks out his truck with a giant drill and a flamethrower, and it just has awesome written all over it. It must be, and instead of like Bigfoot or something, this is like Awesome Foot or something like that. You know, it was directed by Stephen Hilliard Stern, who also directed another very underrated film that starred Tommy Lee Jones from the 80s, The Park Is Mine. So it sounds like it has B-movie written all over it, but, you know, there's a chance for this to be quite a memorable event.
Yeah, Stephen Stern probably is best known for doing a lot of TV movies like in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you know, like practically dozens, but I think even The Park Is Mine was a TV movie. He's probably best known for doing Breaking the Surface, the one about Greg Louganis.
Yeah.
That Mario Lopez was in. I believe that was on USA back in the day. I remember that being pretty hyped up at the time. Stern is one of those guys that haven't really got a chance to delve into his films yet, but Rolling Vengeance is a pretty well regarded bit of guilty pleasure cheese, and it's one I'm really excited to see. Honestly, it'd kind of make a great double feature of Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
Two down on their luck working men getting revenge against the system, with tricked out modes of transportation.
Yeah. That's actually quite the parallel to be drawn there, Joel. That's why I have you on the show, man.
That's what I do. I just compare everything to Rolling Vengeance.
Everything's fine. It's like 6 degrees of Rolling Vengeance.
Yes.
We got another one from Kino, as mentioned. This one from 1990. It's called Night Angel. I have not seen this, but it's another one that sounds pretty awesome. There's like an evil spirit posing as a cover girl and she uses her beauty to seduce and destroy men. And only Johnny Cage himself, Lyndon Ashby, can stop her with true love.
So if you were, you know, hashtagging Gamergate a couple years back, this seems like the movie for you. you know, this is, I mean, it's probably not trying to be, like, misogynistic. It's just a succubus story, pretty much. It does, aside from Johnny Cage himself, it does have Karen Black in it. I'm always curious to see what she's doing with a role, you know, no matter how notable. It's an early Doug Jones performance, actually, which is really interesting.
Oh yeah, Doug Jones.
Yeah. You know, years before he would become famous doing CGI characters, like this was one of his early roles. Right after he got done as Mac Tonight on the McDonaldland TV series.
Don't remember that at all.
Missing out. And, you know, before he would be in Hocus Pocus, which is now the official horror movie of 90s kids.
Yeah, I don't...
Too lame to watch The Monster Squad like the rest of us.
I can't tell you how many movie theaters I've seen, you know, through online Googling and stuff like that. How many movie theaters I've seen that are running Hocus Pocus this season?
If you're basic and you want to celebrate Halloween but don't want to actually be scared or feel emotions, you go watch Hocus Pocus. But also, Night Angel does have one of the great midget actors of our day, Phil Fondacaro.
Oh, and it's directed by the director of Halloween 5, Dominique Othen and Gerard.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Who also did Omen 4, the TV movie with, like, the female Antichrist?
Yeah, so we got a little bit of a horror pedigree here with the director.
And, yeah, I think they've done a couple other horror films here and there. After Darkness with John Hurt and Julian Sands from 85, which... Has that gotten a Scream Factory release? I don't remember. I'm thinking of After Midnight. Never mind.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, Night Angel is definitely another interesting selection here from Kino Classics. But this next one that we're going to talk about is probably the biggest classic of the trio that we're discussing right now.
This is one of the big classic releases of the entire season, if not year. This is one people have been waiting for a very long time, and Kino's to be commended for actually getting the rights to this sorted out somehow.
Yeah, from 1986, Rawhead Rex is hitting the Blu-ray streets. We got it. Yeah. Basically, to sum it up, as only I know how to, an Irish guy plows his field and breaks an ancient seal and unleashes Rawhead Rex upon us.
Could happen to any of us.
Yeah. You gotta watch your cornfields for ancient demonic seals. You know, you never know what you run into. Of course, the big thing about Rawhead Rex, of course, it's a Clive Barker story. It's written by Clive Barker.
Yeah, and I haven't actually read the story, so I don't know how close the film is.
I was under the impression it was written for the screen by Clive Barker.
Oh, I thought it was based on one of his stories. I kind of assumed that because I know he did the screenplay too, but I also know he hated the result, and that's why he was so involved in that's why he directed Hellraiser, because he just didn't want to go through that again.
Yeah. So, what we know about Rawhead Rex, though, Joel, is that I don't know how he could be disappointed with what came out on screen. I mean, Rawhead Rex is one of those movies, and like you mentioned, it's it was kind of missing from a lot of collections for the longest time, and to finally have it come out on Blu-ray, courtesy of Kino, is kind of a coup for them.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge statement. I mean, and not that Kino needs to prove anything to the horror community, because Kino's just, in general, an extremely successful label, but, I mean, they managed to pull off something that, you know, Scream hasn't done, that Synapse, Severin, like, none of these companies have been able to pull off getting the rights to those Untangled. That's as big a coup as Scream getting Hell Knight out in December. These are probably the two of those are probably the biggest, most anticipated releases of the entire year for horror fans. So, I mean, it's pretty impressive that they managed to finally pull this off.
Yeah, and I think a good double bill recommendation there. If you pick up Rawhead Rex on Blu-ray from Kino, go ahead and double up with a movie we talked about not that long ago, Pumpkinhead. And you got yourself a pretty decent double bill there.
Oh, absolutely. Classic creature features.
Yeah. So those were releases from last week, October the 17th releases. This week, this coming week, release dates of October the 24th. Let's hit on a few of these. Let's start with the big one, newer film, War for the Planet of the Apes. I have not seen it. I'm a fan of the first two films. They seem to be very modernized versions, of course, of the original series, but I found them to be quite entertaining, the first two, and this one I've been waiting to see and haven't had the opportunity to see it yet. And so War for the Planet of the Apes should be in my collection very soon.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen any of the new Planet of the Apes films. Like, it's not a statement of, you know, disinterest in them, because people who I trust to know cult films and to know quality films have been almost unanimously positive about these movies. Yeah. I mean, a lot of work is put into them. They're very well crafted. I mean, they're full of CGI, but the CGI is extremely detailed and realistic, and not like, it doesn't feel fake. It doesn't feel like it's got a hard seam like a lot of modern CGI creations.
Yeah, that's a very good point to make about that. That is very accurate.
So I mean, it's really impressive work. It's just really, I mean, at some point, I'm really gonna have to sit down with this trilogy and just give it a watch. I've never been a huge fan of Planet of the Apes in general. I mean, it's cool, but it's just something about aesthetically has never captured me, even though, you know, the writing, especially in the first, which was, of course, created by Rod Serling himself, is very good. Like, and of course, there's some great actors attached, Roddy McDowall especially. But, yeah, I've just never been a Planet of the Apes dude. I don't know why.
On the other side of the token, I don't know why I've enjoyed the Planet of the Apes films. Except that the Mark Wahlberg one from 2001, that one can go straight to hell.
I thought we all erased that one from history with the current trilogy.
Yeah, that was a Tim Burton, that's right. Oh, my goodness. Tim Burton, what were you thinking? Yeah, but other than that misstep, I've enjoyed the original series. So the modern versions here, that the trilogy that we're talking about now, have been actually a step up from all of that, and very impressive work. So War for the Planet of the Apes coming out this coming week. Another one, newer film, new release to discuss here quickly, is Annabelle Creation in the horror genre here. I have not seen the first Annabelle. I don't think I plan on seeing the first Annabelle. So Annabelle Creation is probably going to elude my shelves. I don't know. What about you, Joel? Have you seen either one of these?
No. That was a very quick turnaround, too, from releasing the movie in theaters to releasing it on Blu-ray. I was wondering why they put it out in the summer, and I kind of assumed it was just to avoid the competition from It, but I'm guessing now it was just so they could, like, double hit it with the theatrical release and Blu-ray in the same year, because there was not going to be much staying power to it.
Yeah, I think, maybe like a 12-week turnaround on that, at least 3 months. I think this hit theaters sometime in July.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, absolutely insane.
Yeah, so I guess maybe there was some, you know, like you said, it was overshadowed by, of course, It when It came out. I think Annabelle Creation was out maybe a week or two before that.
Yeah. Oh, all right. So we have the official release date in the U.S. was August 11th.
Oh man, so only 2 months.
That has to
be some sort of other than, you know, for a widely released film, that has to be some sort of record. I mean, we get stuff coming out on video on demand and simultaneously released on DVD, you know, but for something that was widely released like this one, that has to be some sort of record for. Turnaround.
I mean, I'm guessing it's just because it's an unusually competitive fall for horror movies now that there's no guaranteed big franchise anymore, like there was with the years of Saw being the dominant franchise and then the years of Paranormal Activity. And, you know, we have, of course, the Insidious franchise, which Annabelle is an offshoot of, but, you know, now horror is so thriving that there's tons of competition. I guess they just want to make their money now and run. Now, I haven't seen Annabelle Creation or the original Annabelle. I would suggest to anybody to watch the Half in the Bag review at Red Letter Media on YouTube of Annabelle Creation, where they talk about largely about a contest that was created centered around the release, where you could create a short film in the Annabelle Insidious world and possibly like sell your idea to the film company and receive $50 for it. I kid you not, like the entire stuff.
You're going to make a short film. You're going to putting who knows how much of your own sweat and blood into it, and you're only going to get $50 back.
Yeah, you get check out the Red Letter Media review, the Half in the Bag review, because they were considering doing a short film for the contest, and then they actually like read through the rules, and it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazingly shady and just really exploitative. I doubt there hasn't been too much blowback about it, but you know, I would imagine Annabelle is not an Insidious film. It's a Conjuring film, I believe. I'm always getting all those mixed up. Yeah, so you can do your Conjuring offshoot film, sell them the rights to do something with it for a distinct period of time for $50, and if they decide to make it into a movie or do anything else with it, you will get another $50 American to do it. I don't think the contest is still going on. I'm not sure if they cut it short because someone actually bothered to look at the rules and tell people what the situation was, but it was pretty shady, and it's hard for me to say, wow, I really want to see more Conjuring and Annabelle films, knowing that they're trying to basically steal intellectual property ideas from their fan base.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that sounds like, I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds like a very shady deal. Well, you basically can turn over your own intellectual property and get nothing back. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. The world's an awesome place.
Woo!
Yay, us. Well, let's look at a few others here. Let's get out of that realm here a little bit and look at some actual good movies that are coming out this coming week. We'll start with... I don't know. I'm assuming this is one of Joel's favorites from 1971. Vinegar Syndrome is releasing The Corpse Grinders. Basically, just in quick detail, a cat food company kind of hurting for business. They decide to use dead bodies they pull out from a cemetery, I guess, to turn into cat food. And inevitably, of course, cats are going to eat it, and they turn into... Bloodthirsty Maniacs.
You know, I do love Maniac Cax, but unfortunately, I'm going to have to disappoint you. I haven't seen Corpse Grinders yet. This is a Ted Mikkels film, and I've seen a few of his films, but almost, I think all the ones of his I've watched have been in the
sexploitation genre. I've seen Wonder Woman.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen Doll Squad. I've seen 10 Violent Women. I haven't seen Astro Zombies, which I know he produced. I think he may have also directed. And I have not seen Corpse Grinders, but you know, Vinegar usually has a booth at Hudson Horror Show. The next one is coming up in December, so there's a very good chance they'll actually buy this.
Okay, great.
Sight unseen.
Well, actually, Vinegar is coming out with about a handful of releases this week, so we'll hit on all of the Vinegar releases here. After the Corpse Grinders, we've got one from 1990 called Demon Wind. Not familiar with this, but the gist of it is, I believe, a dude and his friends are searching for the truth surrounding his grandparents' deaths, and they stumble into something called the Demon Wind. That's about all I know. I know that the Blu-ray itself is a 2K restoration of a 35mm negative that was discovered, and it never was before released on DVD, so it's making the jump from, you know, I'm sure it was on VHS, and it's disappeared for a while, and now it's getting the Blu-ray release.
Yeah, this is an incredibly obscure one. Despite the fairly recent vintage of it, I mean, it's a 1990 film, but I think it probably hit at that era where the VHS boom was pretty much dead by that point. Like, stores didn't really need that influx of new stuff anymore, you know, new cheap films just to fill the shelves. So it's kind of a forgotten one. I'm curious about this, about it. I saw the trailer on Vanger's YouTube page not long ago, and it seemed pretty hilarious. Yeah. So at some point I'll give this one a look, because it seems pretty fun.
You just go to Vinegar's booth at Hudson Horror Show with about $500 in cash, and you pick up all of these.
I just give them a blank check and, you know, an IOU for my firstborn. And, I mean, joke's on them, because, you know, I've got so many out there, I have no idea which one the first is. But... You know, Vanger, they just toss out such weird stuff all the time. And what's interesting is they find this incredibly obscure stuff that's very recent. Like, I mean, late 80s, early 90s, like, yeah. Stuff that's already been just lost to time, and it's new.
Yeah, so that's going to segue into the next one from Vinegar that we're going to talk about. It's actually a double movie. Two movie set, Primeval and Lurkers. They're both from 88. Now, Primeval, I believe I've seen it in the public domain. I'm not 100% sure on that, but it's possible. Basically, Primeval is a bunch of devil-worshipping monks running roughshod over the city looking for sacrifice victims. So we've got that. And then Lurkers, I'm not familiar with this one, but... the premise of the plot is a woman returning to her childhood home, where years before she saw her insane mother murder her father and almost murder her. So she returns years later, and she's transformed into a lurker, which I can only assume is not a good thing.
And these films do have a connection. They have the same director, Roberta Finlay, who is a fairly prolific underground filmmaker. Started out her career in pornography and sexploitation, and she eventually moved on mostly to horror by the 80s and 90s, although she's probably best known for the gang revenge film Tenement from 1985.
Oh, yeah, Tenement. I'm familiar with Tenement. Yeah, that's a good film.
Yeah, that's probably uncontestedly her most known film. It is one of her directing efforts, although she's done, like, pretty much everything. I mean, acting, writing, editing, cinematography, like, anything you can do on a film, probably catering to. Like, she's done, because she makes, you know, extremely low budget films where you sort of have to do everything on your own. But she's someone whose filmography I've always meant to really dive into, because it's, you know, even now fairly rare to see like such a prolific female filmmaker, just because of the way the industry works, and especially to see a woman doing that kind of really no budget weird exploitation stuff in the 80s. Like, it's an interesting little niche. I'd really love to see what she does with it.
Yeah. So then this two movie set, Primeval and Lurkers, might be something of interest for you then, Joel. And one more from Vinegar, it'll be coming out this coming week, from 1983, is a movie called Blood Beast. And the summation of this one makes it sound pretty awesome. A Wisconsin Christmas is spoiled by the appearance of a murderous samurai. Samurais in Wisconsin, they kind of go together like chocolate and peanut butter.
I mean, how could they not? You got the samurais, you got the Packers, like, you know, everything you could possibly want. This is one I've actually seen. I can proudly and shamefacedly say I've seen Bloodbeat. You know, it has its moments. It's a fun, stupid little film. Occasionally draggy in some parts, as a lot of these zero-budget, like, 80s horror films are. But it's got enough strangeness to keep it compelling. And, of course, the special effects are just fantastically bad.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check this one out. I have a Roku, and there's a channel I have on there called B-Movie TV. Great channel, by the way, especially if you're into movies like this. And I do believe I may have come across Bloodbeat on there one time, and I have not seen it on there since. They do tend to recycle their movies on there from time to time. But it was interesting from a low-budget standpoint, and it was a very low budget from what I can remember. But unfortunately, my attention was turned elsewhere, and I didn't get to finish the film. So I'm going to have to seek this one out.
Yeah, this is it's another fairly forgotten one that Vanger's unearthed, and I think it's definitely worth a watch. I mean, they've put out some stuff that I think is just absolutely execrable in the past, like Nightmare Weekend I always point to, because that film was almost unwatchable. But Bloodbeat has its moments. It's got, you know, it's got a great weird concept. The special effects are fun and terrible. You know, some of the editing is actually kind of decent. Like, there's a lot of like quick cuts during the murder scenes between like this woman possessed by the samurai, which, just being able to say that this woman possessed by the samurai is probably makes this film worth watching. And, you know, the actual murder taking place, and she's getting all almost orgasmic. You know, there's some interestingly, like, lurid, weird, just, you know, absolute trash going on here. So it's probably worth a watch.
Yeah, it actually sounds a little bit like one of our favorite movies, The House Where Evil Dwells.
They would make a great double feature, yeah.
Except I don't think this budget could even afford to make papier-mâché giant crabs.
I don't think they could afford to steal crabs from a Red Lobster.
let's move on. We've got some Arrow video releases to hit on, Joel. A couple. I know this one you expressed some excitement in when you heard about it. from 1976, it's J.D.'s Revenge. And it's basically blaxploitation horror mashup. It looks like the plot synopsis basically is during a hypnosis act. We've got the character Ike is possessed by the spirit of an evil gangster, causing him to go out on a murderous revenge spree. And it's directed by Arthur Marx, who is notable in the blaxploitation genre. He directed Friday Foster.
Yeah, no. This is a movie that has a pretty great pedigree. Marks also made Detroit 9000, which is one of the like when people make lists of great black exploitation films, that always ends up near the top. He did Bucktown. He's directed and produced a ton of TV. He did Bonnie's Kids, of course. Directed and produced a ton of TV, including, like, he directed something like 75 episodes of Perry Mason.
Hey, cool. Yeah.
Like just a crazy amount of TV work, and produced a ton of Perry Mason as well. This is a legitimately excellent film, I think. Like, of course, it's low budget. It's very gritty. But, it's got a really good lead performance by Glenn Turman, who you might know from Cooley High, which is, not just a great blaxploitation film, but one of the, I think, all-time great coming-of-age films. Lou Gossett Jr.'s in it. Like, it's just got a really excellent cast. It's basically a blaxploitation Jekyll and Hyde. And it's just, it's weird, it's funny, but, the serious moments land really well. Like, it's actually, a lot of blaxploitation films, as fun as they are, just like, they like to take this genre and film it with black people. But this is one where it seems to have a lot to say about inherited anger, about revenge, about dealing with the worst parts of your personality in, like, classic Jekyll and Hyde fashion. Of course, a lot of that's helped by Glenn Turman just being awesome. But yeah, this is, a film that, like, it's a fun, goofy blaxploitation film, and it's a legitimately good, internal horror film.
Yeah, yeah. To throw out a recommendation there, I would say double this one up with Sugar Hill, and you got yourself a pretty good double bill there also.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah. Another one from Arrow Video coming out this week. This is a straight DVD release rather than a Blu-ray from 1963. It's Blood Feast. I haven't seen this one, Joel, and so I'm hoping that you've got something to go for it.
No, unfortunately, I haven't seen it. The only Herschel Gordon Lewis film I've seen is Wizard of Gore, but this is one of his more notable and famous films. It's along with 2000 Maniacs, this is probably the film that gets most associated with Lewis and with gore films in general. So it's probably worth it just for the notability in the horror realm to begin with, but also, I don't think it really needs a Blu-ray release, because I'm not sure how good you're going to make a Herschel Gordon Lewis film look. I don't care what, like, film elements you have. I have no clue how you're going to be able to pull that off. Just classic, weird, campy stuff. This is one of the more high-concept Gordon Lewis films, because they're killing women to bring to life an Egyptian goddess, rather than just killing women because, they have special effects to use.
Yeah, so it sounds slightly interesting to me. My tastes in terms of horror probably go more into the 70s and 80s and the early 90s, but this one seems like something I might want to at least check out in passing.
And Lewis's films are typically interesting just historically, because he fits in that weird realm where it was after the Hays Code died, after the expansion of grindhouse theaters and drive-ins, where you could start pushing the envelope a bit, and no one really pushed the envelope to quite the extent that he did in terms of providing gore, providing shock value. So, I mean, he's an interesting, figure in the horror pantheon.
Okay. Moving on, and we got a couple of the big studios releasing some stuff this week. We'll start with Sony. They've got an oldie. from 1932. The movie The Old Dark House, starring Boris Karloff, and directed by James Whale, the director of the original Frankenstein. So we got some good solid horror pedigree here in The Old Dark House.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a classic film, one that, you know, its impact has probably been dulled over the years by so many films that incorporated that style. You know, it's definitely not a classic on the level of Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, but it's, you know, it's a pretty remarkable moment in film on its own. I mean, this is a 4K restoration, like using a lot of elements that were thought lost for a very long time. This is a pretty great release, and it's one I'll probably pick up at some point just because I love when this kind of moment in early film history gets captured for, you know, generations later.
Yeah, of course. This is during the time, you know, you had the release of Frankenstein. Universal monster movie had not yet been a thing. It was just developing at this point. So this is early in the, cinematic monster. There's not really any monsters in the film. Like, we've got Karloff, but who portrayed Frankenstein. So, but it's in the same vein as the Universal horror films, really.
Yeah, and it's a really sort of more cheeky, like witty, sort of satirical comedy take on early horror. It's apparently very gay coded. Like, I've read essays about it in works on, you know, homosexuality in horror films. Yeah. I can't really speak to that because, like, a lot of that stuff would probably go over my head watching it. But it's also one that's had some legal issues surrounding it. Like, it's never been syndicated for TV, so that's probably why it's been less notable than a lot of the other classic Universal stuff, just because there was less they could do with it. You know, despite the fact that it has a pretty classic cast, like Charles Lawton's in here, Bly from Mutiny on the Bounty himself, like Melvin Douglas is in it, Gloria Stewart, the old lady from Titanic.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Like, it's got a pretty remarkable cast. It's a chance for, like, a lot of very, like, a lot of great old actors with a lot of personality, a lot of theatricality and campiness to just play off each other.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's look at a couple of other, we're almost through with these. Let's look at a couple of Paramount releases here, Joel. From 1976, Marathon Man, starring Dustin Hoffman. I'm familiar with that film. I can't say that I've seen it from beginning to end, but I'm just thinking that, you know, the Blu-ray release from Paramount, I'm not sure what additions are making to the Blu-ray, like the extras, but Marathon Man itself is a classic film from the mid-70s, especially during the post-Nixon era. So, I mean, there's a lot of things to be said here in a movie like Marathon Man.
Yeah, you know, that 70s era of return to paranoia thrillers yielded some really cool stuff. I'm a big fan of 3 Days at the Condor, The Conversation, Marathon Man's great, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake. It's a pretty cool moment in film because there were a lot of quality filmmakers, a lot of great cast working on this kind of stuff. So this is probably going to be just a bare bones Blu-ray. I didn't see anything particularly, you know, wild about it, but it's also an extremely expensive one. So if you don't have Marathon Man, go and pick up Marathon Man.
Yeah, also from Paramount, from 2009, a movie called The Uninvited. Now, I'm familiar with this in title. I know it's probably been missed by a lot of people, a lot of, you know, if there's a lot of horror genre fans out there, The Uninvited is probably one of those movies that was easily missed in 2009. In this, you were the one telling me that this was a remake of a movie called Tale of Two Sisters, right?
Yeah, the modern classic South Korean horror film. I haven't seen The Uninvited yet. And I should say that it has nothing to do with the classic 40s Uninvited. This is a remake of Tale of Two Sisters specifically. This was after the era where J-horror and... I don't even think there were really any Korean horror remakes aside from this one. But after the era of remaking Asian horror flicks kind of died when The Ring 2 hit with a resounding thud. And they also kind of saturated the market, like, with stuff like One Missed Call, The Eye. Like, nah, all of them did sort of, business, like, made their money back, I'm sure, because they weren't particularly expensive. But, you know, none of them really seem to have much in the way of style, or the first American Ring and the first American Grudge. Of course, Grudge had the benefit of being directed by the original director of the Grudge. The first American Ring, which is not great compared to the original Ringu, but because they overload on the digital color correcting, but it is done by Gore Verbinski, who did, most famous for Pirates of the Caribbean and, most infamous for The Lone Ranger. But he's a director with an actual level of talent to him. It's probably the least terrible screenplay Erin Kruger has ever written. But it's also got a decent cast. Of course, now I'm talking about a film that's not even being released this week because The Uninvited is just that uninteresting. But The Uninvited, which I think had a few young actors who would go on to some level of fame, like Emily Browning's in it, Elizabeth Banks, like David Strathairn's in it. So, yeah, I don't know, maybe he's worth watching the movie for. The cast seems at least like... capable. I don't know if there's really anything particularly like exciting about this. It's probably just out there because it's Halloween and they can make a couple extra bucks on a movie they had in the archive.
It is Paramount. I mean, don't they put out box sets of Friday the 13th at least twice a year?
Pretty much, and then they make them really hard to find or make them store exclusives, and they don't actually do anything new with the box sets. They almost put them out begrudgingly because they hate that Friday the 13th makes them so much money.
Yeah. Well, one more to talk about here, Joel, because we had quite a list for this coming week. And let's talk about, I think this is a Warner Brothers release from 1995. It's Virtuosity. With Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe. And the thing with Russell Crowe in this film, sorry, Joel, but...
go on.
I just wanted to get it out that most people, know Russell Crowe as this stoic, grouchy, grumpy old man in his movies. But here in Virtuosity, he's actually quite an entertaining funny villain playing it over the top here. This is kind of like a Russell Crowe that you don't really see much.
Yeah, no, this was an awesomely fun, stupid little movie from the mid-90s during the cyber era where everything was cyber and virtual reality.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when those concepts were... concepts were all new and exciting to our poor Sega Genesis addled little 90s minds. And I mean, to the point where the tagline of this film, I shit you not, was Justice Needs a New Program.
That's quite
And it's also directed by the guy who did The Lawnmower Man, if I recall.
Oh yeah, so there's definitely a high element of techno cheese in this movie. And I actually, as an aside, I believe Virtuosity just recently got the "How did this get made?" treatment. So there's a lot to be said about Virtuosity. I'm surprised that the Riff Trax guys haven't gotten their hands on it yet, but this is a keeper.
It's a pretty great cheesy stupid movie. I remember loving it when it came out because as like a 9-year old, I was all in on like our cyber future. it's got a really good supporting cast, like absolutely slumming it. I mean, like William Forsythe is here, Louise Fletcher, William Fichtner, even a very young, and I don't know how to pronounce her name, Kaylee, Cuoco, from Big Bang Theory. Oh. I have no idea how to say that.
I don't even watch Big Bang, so I know who you're talking about, but I don't care to pronounce their names.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hate that show. It's just an intro, and that's probably one of the impetuses for putting this out. Like, oh, hey, it's got, for the curious who love Big Bang Theory. It's, you know, the lead actress has like a young girl,
yeah,
like. Even before she was on like Charmed for the last season or whatever. No, it's an extraordinarily stupid movie. It's the right level of like Demolition Man style stupid.
Uh-huh.
I was
about to say that's a good companion piece to it. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, it's got Denzel at his most Denzel-ish.
Yeah.
It's a stupid movie. It's probably a bad movie, although, you know, at least competently made, but it's an extremely fun movie, and it's totally worth watching. I mean, for our old Russell Crowe shame itself, it's worth it just for that. I mean, of course, this is before he would be known to Americans. I'm not sure what his big breakthrough was, although I would assume it's probably L.A. Confidential was the moment where people in America really knew who he was.
Well, they started taking notice, yeah. I mean, yeah. Here he was. He was lower than Denzel on the marquee. He was the co-star, or he was the supporting actor. And, of course, L.A. Confidential, you know, shot him into the stratosphere a little bit in terms of leading man.
Yeah, and you know, credit to Denzel, because even now, like he, depending on the roles, he might be first on the marquee above Russell Crowe, because he's managed to be, you know, one of our biggest actors for such an extremely long period of time.
Yeah, he's great amount of longevity on Denzel here. It's actually surprising, you know, and you can still look at his filmography and still see a bunch of big hits in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is before Denzel really became kind of a self-parody, but you can definitely see his like classic tics on display here. It's not one, you know, it's not one of his really like, there's trying Denzel where he's really immersed in a character and really good. Like, you know, you can see that Denzel in like, I don't know, like The Hurricane or American Gangster or something like that. And then there's like John Q. Denzel, and this is like John Q. Denzel.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good comparison there. So Virtuosity is getting a Blu-ray release this week from Warner Brothers. So you can check it out. It is a fun movie and a stupid one at that, but it's enjoyable.
It's the best kind of stupid.
All right, so we've summed up your new releases that are out there right now. By the time you listen to this podcast, they'll be on shelves waiting for you. But we've got a couple of movies to talk about this week, Joe. We want to talk about another new release. You know, we did It a few weeks back. As we expand our horizons here a little bit at Go Home in the Box, we want to talk about some new releases. We're going to talk about Happy Death Day. In the horror genre here, of course. And what's the deal with this movie, Joel? Well, let's see. We've got a lot of comparisons to Groundhog. It's kind of like Groundhog Day meets Scream to some people. but basically the concept is we've got a young college girl who is murdered on her birthday, and she gets to relive the same day over and over until she decides to find out who her killer is and put a stop to it. Directed by Christopher B. Landon, the son of the late Michael Landon. Christopher Landon, he was the screenwriter for Disturbia, Paranormal Activity, several of them, actually, 2, 3, 4, The Marked Ones. And he also wrote The Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which he also directed, which is actually an underrated film. I recommend Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Yeah, and there's an interesting little backstory to that film where they were attempting a same-day video on demand release, you know, on the same day they released it to theater.
Yeah.
And a lot of theaters ended up boycotting it because of that, so it kind of got shafted by them attempting to do something that was probably not in their best interest. But it's got to be one or the other, because you're never going to please everyone with that kind of thing. But he directed Scout's Guide as well as wrote it. And also, I haven't seen Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones. I've only seen the first and last Paranormal Activities, but I know he also directed The Marked Ones as well as wrote that. And yeah. I know that one is sort of a spin-off side one that people seem to like better than a lot of the later sequels, because it's a less serious and sort of a more distinctive one. I know it's like it was sort of heavily marketed to like a Latino audience. It's very like Day of the Dead oriented.
Yeah.
And it's, trying to be like a more comedic, less self-serious take on the Paranormal Activity films.
Yeah, that's just one note I wanted to make about the Paranormal Activity films. I didn't realize that the Paranormal Activity films required a screenwriter, Joel, because they were supposed to be found footage films.
I thought it was real.
I thought it was real too, man. Come on, movies are lying to me. I can't believe movies would make shit up.
Yeah, Next you'll tell me the Blair Witch Project was fake too.
So we've got Christopher B. Landon behind the camera here, who's got a pretty good knowledge of the horror genre on his resume. And here's another interesting aspect here, Joel. You're a fan of comic books. The writer for Happy Death Day is Scott Lobdell, who wrote many issues of Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of that. He wrote a ton of X-Men.
Basically the X-Men universe, I guess. He was the driving force behind a lot of the spin-offs as well.
Oh yeah, Generation X did a lot of work in X-Factor, Excalibur. I mean, I'm not a huge X-Men fan, but he's an extremely long-lived writer for Marvel. He's probably most famous recently for his work on the very polarizing Red Hood and the Outlaws series that came out with DC's New 52, which was basically a bit more honest about what DC fans would probably like to read, which is stupid action Starfire wearing like dental floss as a costume. But I give him credit for his honesty there. So like a lot of his stuff I'm not terribly familiar with. Like he is probably best known for being one of the main people behind the Age of Apocalypse story in X-Men, which is one of the most highly regarded X-Men storylines in history. But he was one of the big minds behind X-Men in the 90s. And Generation X, of course, got made into a Jack Shoulder TV movie. The comic itself is not bad, mostly because Chris Bacalo is on art, and he's just phenomenal. I'm not a big X-Men fan, but Lob Del's contribution to the X-Men is pretty significant. I mean, if you read X-Men the 90s, and you know, considering sales figures, a lot of people read X-Men the 90s before the comic book crash in 96. This is probably a guy whose work you're familiar with.
So yeah, this I believe, to my understanding, this would be his big screen screenwriting debut. So this was this is quite the leap for him, I believe, from comic books.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually I'm surprised, given Christopher Landing's history, that he's Scott Lobdell has apparently did some of the writing, some uncredited writing on Days of Future Past, okay, the X-Men movie, but and did some, I think may have done some writing for the cartoon series on Fox in the 90s. He's done some TV movie writing, but his most famous work until now, movie-wise, was being one of the creators of the story of the Tommy Lee Jones comedy Man of the House.
Man of the House. Yeah. Skip it.
Do not skip Man of the House. It is a classic. But yeah, so it's surprising that, I don't know if this was just, you know, his idea that he brought to Blumhouse, and we should say that this is a Blumhouse Productions film, who are basically the guys who give you horror films now.
Yeah,
like, right. if you go to see a horror movie and it's not it is probably Blumhouse, and they've been extraordinarily successful. I mean, you know, they did Get Out, which I think one of the reasons they're so successful, aside from like knowing what audiences want, is also they've taken a lot of chances on interesting concepts in horror movies. Get Out being, of course, the most notable, and I'm sure the best film they've done by this point. But Happy Death Day, I did enjoy, and it's an interesting concept. You know, it's a very sci-fi concept for a horror film, which is probably the hand of Scott Lobdell doing like very comic book science fiction epochs,
yeah,
for most of his career. But yeah, this is a Blumhouse film with like a ridiculously small budget for a modern theatrical film. It's like $4.5 million or something like that, and it's like, you know, made 10 times that amount already.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a big, I mean, it was the top movie at the box office its opening weekend, so it's definitely making back its money. Interesting note I want to touch on this real quick is that it was originally conceived way back in, as far back as 2007. It was originally supposed to have Megan Fox set the
star. Oh, that's right, and
Michael Bay was going to produce it.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
I mean, I'm so glad that didn't happen.
Yeah.
I'm sure we would have had a vastly different movie.
Oh, absolutely. Now, we should also say, though, it's not necessarily it is actually kind of involved in a side plot here in this film. Christopher Landon is one of our rare openly gay filmmakers in Hollywood right now.
Yes, he is.
And that does come into play. It has like a jokey side plot in this film, but you know, it's interesting because just in the context of Blumhouse, how even though their stuff fits in very well with what modern horror audiences want, how they're actively looking for perspectives that aren't like, it's like, you know, Get Out being directed by Jordan Peele, like that's not what you'd necessarily expect for a modern big budget or semi-big budget mainstream horror film. But like, Blumhouse is at least giving, like, creating opportunities with new ideas and new people, which is probably why they're successful. And then Hollywood is going to totally ignore that aspect of it.
Of course they are. But of course, then again, if this movie continues to be successful, you never know. You know, Hollywood may decide to take credit for all of it. let's touch on the cast a little bit here. Of course, the star, I may be butchering the pronunciation of her last name, but I want to say it's Jessica Roth.
I've been saying Roth, but I have no clue.
Okay. Well,
I'm so bad with pronunciation.
She, well, I mean, as far as her resume goes prior to this, she had a role in La La Land, and she had some various television appearances as well. Basically, she's the main character in the film Tree. Tree is the character is basically not a good person at the beginning of the film. You know, self-centered, condescending. She ignores calls from her dad. She sleeps around apparently quite a bit. That's hinted at, more than hinted at actually. But what would you think of? I thought, and of course, you know, the progression of that character towards the end of the film. I don't know. Star-making performance, you think, Joe?
Oh, I'd say easily. I'd say that's aside from this film being extremely successful on such a small budget and with no-name actors, I'd say that's going to be the major takeaway from this, is that that's an absolutely star-making performance. And it's a difficult one to carry the audience with you, because for about the first third of the movie, really, she's got to be just the worst person.
It's not a very good character to get behind, you know, when that's usually the kind of character that you applaud when they get murdered in a movie like this.
Yeah, and she's our entire, like, point of view. And then she's got to do the difficult, like, you know, magic act of growing her character and making us like her after we've seen her do all these lousy things and just be a selfish, self-centered person. But the film gives us reason. It's not like Groundhog Day, where I think it even goes a little further in Groundhog Day than Groundhog Day did in its examination of a person, where, you know, one of the things with Groundhog Day is that, you know, Bill Murray is in a new location with new people around. So it does, the situation, the repeating his day does allow him to examine his own behavior. But what I find almost a little more interesting here is that not only does she get to examine her own behavior through repetition, but also, like, the behavior of the people around her and the people who have a terrible influence on her and the people who have a good influence on her. And she also gets to examine the way she affects the people she lives with day in, day out. It's not just like, in Groundhog Day, I'm an asshole because I'm terrible to all these new people who annoy me. It's in Happy Death Day, I'm an asshole because I'm terrible to these people who have relied on me for a very long time, and I've let them down.
So, yeah, there's a little bit of a theme of self-examination, you know, going through the course of the movie here. So,
and it's also, I think, like that structure, that repetition, is a great way to sort of examine addiction. Even though it's not explicitly stated, it's pretty clear she's an alcoholic.
It's
only excused because she's at college and at what seems to be a very big party school. So, like, it doesn't seem weird.
Just FYI, research, this was filmed on the campus of Loyola University down in New Orleans. So that's kind of a big school.
I had a feeling, because you see, do see a Louisiana State Police car at one major scene in the film. So, I figure it was like Loyola or Tulane or just one of the many big party schools in that area. And, you know, it's a very sort of satirical and broadly satirical view of college. That put me off in the initial sequence of the film because, you know, even 10 years ago when I was going to college, it was and of course I did not go to a party school or a state school. I went to like a wussy, sensitive little liberal arts school in the Northeast.
Yes.
That was originally a woman-only school until, like, the 60s or 70s. So it's, you know, a different college experience than mine, obviously. I didn't go to, like, a big athletic school with a lot of partying or anything. But, I mean, like, there's just, like, open frat hazing on the quad, which even 10 years ago probably wouldn't have been okay, and that would just be, like, the police would be there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was in the beginning of the film, there's quite a bit of that actually being thrown around. So maybe a little bit of scathing side remark about, you know, the state of colleges and the stuff that gets turned a blind eye to.
Yeah, there's a level of campiness to it. It's a little too broad to be believable. It has sort of a Heather's vibe, I think, or like, you know, maybe sort of a Mean Girl shout out.
Yeah.
I mean, at its worst, I would probably compare it a little bit to, like, you know, Ryan Murphy's TV shows, you know, Scream Queens or Glee or American Horror Story. Like, in that, especially when you get to the sorority, there's a lot, like, the main sorority president is like a complete stereotype, and she's played like that to be humorous and kind of offensive at the same time on some of the stuff she says. But you know, it's that very sort of like Ryan Murphy does nothing but catty, misogynistic female characters kind of thing. I don't think this goes anywhere near as far as his stuff does, but you know, there is that element where it's actively trying to be satirical and maybe goes a bit too broad that route.
Yeah. Okay. So, and you mentioned Mean Girls in there. I just thought of the whole concept of the film was kind of like a hybrid of Groundhog Day and Scream and a dash of Mean Girls thrown in there. So definitely... as I was saying, not a wholly original concept since it's a mashup of other ideas, but moments of humor spread throughout the film kind of keep the mood light, and I think that worked in its favor. But what about, let's touch on some of the other cast members here real quick, like Israel Broussard, who I believe he plays Carter. He was previously in the Bling Ring. I haven't seen the Bling Ring. I don't think I'm going to see the Bling Ring, but I'm familiar with it. And he's also he was also in a couple of episodes of Fear of the Walking Dead. So we've got an up and comer here in Israel Broussard, who I thought was quite enjoyable.
Oh yeah, he's likable. He's like that right level of nice guy, but doesn't seem like a clinger or a whiner. He's not like, you know, Michael Cera. He's not like, he's not like overly self-involved like John Cusack.
Yeah.
Like, no, he just seems like a genuinely like decent dude. And I think part of what makes this film work, because it plays with a lot, it plays with, like you said, there's a dash of Mean Girls. It plays with a lot of like young, there's like a sort of gently, slowly developing love story in this. And it you know, with a big 16 candle shout out near the end, and it plays with that stuff. But I think it does, like, you know, one of my least favorite archetypes in like teen film is the dogged nice guy. And the thing about him is because we're only seeing the acts he like does during one day, it never seems like he's like one of those awful like nice guys who's just hanging around waiting for a girl to change her mind. He's just like acting in the moment, and the whole point is that like she's noticing the repetition of one day and realizes that he's actually like a worthwhile, healthy person to keep around her. Rather than like he's just gonna try for obsessively for months and months.
And there, and as in terms of the character itself of Carter, I mean, there's a gag at the end of the movie that was pretty funny. And so, I mean, that's the character of Carter that was pretty intelligent. Of course, he's the character that gives Tree the idea to, you know, figure out her killer while she's in this endless loop. And there's some intelligence in the character there and some wit as well at the end of the film.
Oh yeah, we like just based on his dorm room, which is the room she wakes up in, and yeah, of course has a reassurance to the audience. We find out fairly early that like they didn't sleep together because obviously we'd hate him if he took advantage of a drunk girl, but yeah, we see his dorm room and he's got tons of movie posters. Right, he's got They Live and Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie. So we know he's like he's the genre savvy guy. He's the guy who's like gonna see this situation. And, you know, he straight up lampshades Groundhog Day at one point, because I don't think the film almost had to lampshade Groundhog Day.
Oh, yeah. It's referenced in the movie, when they talk about the events in Groundhog Day at one point in the movie. So, yeah. And that was intended. So I guess it is intended to be a kind of a bit of a shout out to Groundhog Day.
Yeah. I think that was like heading everyone off at the pass, because everyone's going to spend the movie thinking about Groundhog Day, and they're saying, yes, this is Groundhog Day, we know it, just deal with it.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I'd actually less than Groundhog Day, although, you know, there's such a self-examination element that Groundhog Day also possesses, but, you know, it's also very reminiscent of the Tom Cruise film Edge of Tomorrow, which is based on a Japanese novel and manga called All You Need Is Kill, which is, you know, that cyclical dying and living again plot done as a sci-fi war story.
Yeah.
And that has a lot in common with this in terms of, you know, she's got the Groundhog Day element of self-examination and the Edge of Tomorrow element of trying to use this trial and error method of to like ensure her survival.
Yeah. And one more cast member I want to touch on real quick, of course, is Ruby Modine as the roommate. Of course, that's Matthew Modine's daughter. And I guess currently she's found on I haven't seen the show, but, you know, it's a pretty popular show on the cable channel Showtime. She's in Shameless as the character Sierra. So anyone listening who's familiar with Shameless that hasn't seen Happy Death Day, then Ruby Modine or Sierra is in this film. And that was another good performance and kind of a sly little performance from Ruby Modine.
Yeah, I'd say she's definitely like almost working against the tone of the film, because the film can be very like theatrical and over the top, and she's being she is sly. She's, you know, doing what she does very subtly, you know, and that which works for her role in the film and what she contributes to it. Like, she's a good like sort of separate tone intruding on the film in a way that really works without being overbearing.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so we've got a good... Overall, we've got a good, solid young cast here. They all... it was kind of a surprise. And, you know, they all added depth. Because, you know, if you look at, you know, horror movies in the 80s, you had these brainless teens. They were very depthless and... You know, they're getting killed off one by one. And now in the movie, like Happy Death Day, actually we're putting brains in these kids in a lot of more modern horror films. And it's good to see, because, you know, it's just trying to... it makes you feel more sympathetic to these characters, actually. You know?
Yeah, and first of all, that's an argument we're going to have about 80s horror films at a later day, because the Dream Warriors would take issue with that. But
there are exceptions to every rule, Joel.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, these are not dumb kids. I mean, the first indication we have that there's, like, more depth to Tree than we initially see is that she's in what seems to be a very difficult college course. Like, Like it's clear that she's an intelligent person. She's just, you know, at this point so self-involved that she's not noticing really the world around her. I mean, you know, it's not due to her idiocy that she's being killed. It's more due to her apathy about her surroundings.
Right.
And then we of course get like. We get reasons for that. I mean, there's an ongoing plot about her, you know, her grief over her mother's death, and she and her mother sort of inexplicably share the same birthday. which is also why she's been avoiding her father. I mean, it's, you know, we're given enough to understand. Like, it's, there's a moment I love where her soror, she's watching a video on her phone of her and her mom at a previous birthday, and her sorority president comes in, and she immediately hides the phone like she's ashamed to be, like, viewing an old video of her mom. Yeah. I mean, her sorority president is, like, a total tyrant, like, in a very cartoonish way. But, you know, I feel like even if she wasn't, she'd be sort of embarrassed that she's so, like, she's so wrapped up in her own grief. Like, clearly, it seems very clear that, like, a lot of the stuff she's doing, a lot of the way she's living her life, just, like, partying all the time, and, like, you know, at this point, she's having an ongoing affair with one of her teachers, who, don't get me wrong, he's totally hot. But, like, it's, you know, these are, like, she's making a lot of terrible decisions. Like, and it's clear that she's very much just hiding from something, from herself, hiding from actually actively, like, dealing with her own feelings. I mean, she's clearly miserable. She's miserable, and she's miserable living this life that's not the way she would naturally, like, choose to live her life. But it's clear she's just unhappy and just, like, throwing that everywhere around her.
Yeah, clearly, and of course. As part of the whole self-examination aspect of the film is that's not something she had considered doing previously, and so this series of events that's happening to her, you know, forces her to take inventory, so to speak. So very maybe not so subtle thematic element there to Happy Death, and it was good to see. A couple of other things to touch note real quick. The mask on the killer, the creator of that mask is Tony Gardner, and he's the same guy who created what, Joel? What mask? What
created Ghostface?
He did. He's the creator of Ghostface from Scream. So, so that was a cool little element that I discovered, you know, after looking up the film, because. I previously did not even think to consider who the creator of the Ghostface mask was, but so that was a good tie to Scream, which, you know, a lot of people did see some elements of Scream in this, mainly because of the masked killer element. But
I saw less Scream, and I saw more House on Sorority Row and Happy Birthday to Me. Yeah. For probably obvious reasons, the mask the killer wears, which is a very cartoonish Cupid baby mask, reminded me a lot of not totally, but just enough in concept of the mask from the 2000 slasher Valentine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, it might have been 2001, but you know the movie I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
So there's that element. I'm almost certain, like, there's probably got to be some 80s slasher that did sort of a Cupid mask kind of thing. And in this case, like, it's part of that, like, sort of almost broadly ridiculous parody of college life, where this cartoonish baby mask, which looks like probably looks like the baby from the short before Roger Rabbit, look like, is the mascot of the school, which is almost like community level, like how their mascot is the human beings. Like, their mascot, like this college mascot is the babies. Like,
the babies.
Obviously, that would never happen, but it's amusing.
Yeah. So, that was pretty cool. Let me ask you a question, though, about the whole time loop business, because I couldn't pinpoint anything, but. Do we have an explanation for that?
No.
I mean, we know it's a conceit of the screenplay. It's necessary for, you know, the development of the character and whatnot, and the benefit of the plot. But we're not really provided an explanation as to why Tree is going through the time loop.
No, we don't really have anything. I've heard because
Bill Murray also in Groundhog Day, there was nothing there, but that's played more for comedy, and it might be like a comedic conceit, so to speak. But in a, I guess in a sci-fi-ish type horror slasher film, you know, you would think there'd be maybe some kind of mention as to why this is happening.
Yeah, like you'd want an explanation. I've read that like that's something they're sort of planning to do with the potential sequel.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's almost like I think in order to avoid like the script going overly long or being overly bloated, like it's something they basically had to excise or just leave up to the audience. I wish there was a little more in terms of, you know, suggestions as to why this is happening to her specifically. You know, clearly, like, there's, you know, the fact that her birthday is important, but not in anything, as far as we know, connected to the time loop. You know, there's not really any, like, hints or indications that I could see. At a certain point, I was just, you know, the film it's a very playful film, which I love, and it plays around with its own artificiality, which is great. So, for the most part, it wasn't bothering me because focused more on the mystery of who's like going to be killing her rather than how she's stuck in this loop.
And that was that was going to be my my question to you is did the lack of explanation of the time loop affect your viewing in any way?
You know, it. The film is really good at navigating its own artificiality. So, like, it didn't bother me. It left me wondering, and not in a way where it added, like, there's not enough obliqueness in the film, like, planned artistic obliqueness, for it to be part of the feel of the film. It didn't bother me, but at the same time, I do want an explanation, like, or at least some hint. So it didn't detract, or I should say it didn't detract from my enjoyment of the film, but I would really enjoy having like some sort of indication, like, you know, since so much is made, like, her mom's dead, like, did a similar thing ever happen to her mom? Is it, so they have the same birthday, which is already kind of inexplicable.
Yeah.
Like, that's an amazing coincidence. Like, is it something about that? Like, there's just enough details there to make me think maybe that's significant, but there's not enough to point out something like that has significant rather than just a weird quirky detail.
Yeah. And may I make a suggestion here, maybe throw out an idea or something, because since this movie's making money, there's probably the potential for a sequel is pretty high. And since we have a comic book writer doing the screenwriting for this film, what about the possibility that this time loop business might actually be some type of special, like, comic book style mutant superpower of hers or something like that?
It is entirely possible. You know, because that made me wonder, like, how, so her death affects the world, like, the entire world. Is this something that other people have, like, happens to other people? Is this just something inherent in her? Does she have any other ability to manipulate time? Like, it's almost there are a couple of weird camera moments, especially when they repeat the opening walk sequence, which is probably going to be a minor classic of horror, which is funny because there's nothing horrific about it. Just the way they play around with that opening sequence so consistently is just extremely fun and witty and memorable. But, like, you know, there's enough weirdness around, like, the way she's perceiving and experiencing things in that opening sequence to suggest that maybe there's something more to her than just this time loop in terms of, like, her ability to perceive and affect things around her.
Yeah. And so probably something to chew on as we anticipate a sequel. So I guess, do you have anything to add, Joel? I'm just about to ask you, and I think it's obvious, but we'll just get into our individual recommendation here, but or whether or not we recommend it. But do you have anything else you want to add real quick to it?
Oh, I mean, I just think that it's a film that I don't think succeeds perfectly at everything it does, but it's got enough charm and playfulness, and it is a very playful, very witty film that, like, it does a lot of things very well, and it's an interesting, fun experience. Watching her it's part where watching her process of self-examination is really interesting, and like when she does get a couple of big emotional moments of that, one of which is of course like, you know, finally going to see the dad she's been avoiding all these days. Like, there's actually some affecting emotional moments in there. Like, you know, it's just a process of like slowly. It's a process of slowly breaking down a character's faults and flaws and self-delusions through repetition. It's just a really fascinating process to watch and to watch her increasing awareness of herself. There's a lot to be, and the performances are really likable and really, and there's a lot of legitimately funny moments. Like, yeah, it's definitely a film I would recommend. And it's a film like where there's maybe not necessarily enough to go off of in terms of examining it for some things, like, you know, the nature of the events, but there's enough characterization there where, for me, I'm always more interested in examining a character to begin with.
Okay, very good. And so that is a recommendation from Joel. I agree. Very good. Solid, young, solid cast. They all gave solid performances. No complaints there. Of course, the time loop conceit, it could have used an explanation, but within the context of the film itself, it worked, and so not going to complain too hard about that. And of course, Scott Lobdell's screenplay is witty and intelligent, and so basically this is not really a dumb movie, I wouldn't really consider this a horror film per se. I mean, it has some slasher elements to it, but basically the concept of the time loop really is more of a science fiction film, if you ask me.
I'm sorry, I was going to say something we didn't touch on, because it's added in almost as sort of an artificial clock to the proceedings. But, like, when she incurs injury over the course of her multiple days, she retains that those injuries to an extent.
She weakens, yeah. Right.
So it kind of gives an urgency where there might not be any otherwise. But I would have liked to have seen more with that, like, because that's a really interesting idea that, like, sure, she gets multiple chances, but there's a price here and it's a damaging one.
So another recommendation from me. So that's two thumbs up. I hope we're not infringing on any trademarks there. So.
I don't think anybody's used that before.
One final question, real quick. The potential for this to be a cult classic, what do you think?
I would say a minor one. I wouldn't say it's not going to be a cult classic on the level of, like, Get Out or It is likely to be. Yeah. But I would say it's going to be pretty fondly remembered. But I'd say this is going to be less a cult classic than, like, a film that made a new lead actress.
Right. Well, you see, and I hold the bar up to a movie like, say, Back to the Future here. If that hadn't been so successful, a movie like that would be a cult classic. In my opinion, if it's financially successful, it's a mainstream success, and there was, so therefore being a cult favorite or a cult classic probably a diminishing chance of that happening. So this movie will be remembered, and so therefore I really think as in terms of being a cult classic, I don't think that term should really apply to this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to call like a lot of Blumhouse picks a cult classic. Like even calling Get Out a future cult classic feels like a kind of a misnomer, because it's just a wildly successful film, and I think going to be influential on future horror films, especially in motivating horror films to deal with social issues again, like they, you know, occasionally do, but not always consistently. This is a film where I'm not sure if it's going to inspire more like high concept or sci-fi influenced horror. And I mean sci-fi in the sense that there's a weird scientific concept present, and not necessarily sci-fi in the sense that there's a space monster who's going to rip your head off thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's going to inspire any other, like, sort of high-concept horror or because when you think about something like It Follows, was kind of a high-concept horror. And, you know, this in terms of quality and just in terms of how likely it is to be, like, an influential horror film is not on the level of It Follows. I think if I had to make a prediction, it basically could make a new major actress, and that's going to be the biggest influence of this film.
Yeah, I agree. So there you have it. Happy Death Day. Two recommendations for us. So if you haven't seen it, we recommend it. You should be pleasantly surprised. Okay, so I think that'll do it for Happy Death Day chatter here, Joel. And we're going to take a break here. And when we come back on the other side, we've got another film to talk about. We're going to talk about John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness. So you stay with us. We'll be back in just a few.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all these shows, plus others available at PlaceStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA on-demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed the break. I know I needed it. Plenty to talk about during Happy Death Day. We're going to follow that up with our second film for the week, John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness. And as, of course, we mentioned, John Carpenter behind the camera for this one. I just want to say real quick, Joel, the 90s... really too kind to John Carpenter in terms of success. Not like anywhere near the success he had in the 80s. I mean, we see a lot of the quality of the work, I think, really start to go downhill a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could probably call this Carpenter's last great film. Some people might argue about how great it is, but I think it's an excellent movie and probably his last, like, great full-length film. You know, he didn't do quite as much during the 90s, which is interesting. He, he did some segments for the TV movie Body Bags the year before this.
Village of the Damned.
Yep, the Village of the Damned remake, Escape from L.A., Vampires with action hero James Woods, which is admittedly kind of a guilty pleasure of mine.
Yeah, Vampires was all right, yeah.
Vampire Sex Month. Like, I liked it so much when it came out in theater, I read the book it was based on.
Yeah.
Not a great decision. Not a great joke decision. Memoirs of an Invisible Man he did, which I still haven't seen.
Chevy Chase.
Yeah, I mean, I have my anti-Chevy Chase biases in general, although I do... Yeah. He's been a part of a lot of stuff I like, but he's just such a tool.
I think Chevy Chase gets a pass from a lot of people because of Christmas Vacation. I mean, out of all the vacation movies, Christmas Vacation is the one that everyone remembers most fondly.
Which is interesting. That does seem to be the one that that stuck with everyone. I think maybe, sorry to interrupt, I think maybe it's just because it sort of represents how a lot of people feel around Christmas better than some other nicer the stories.
Yeah. We don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, though. But
too much of a Chevy Chase.
This was just Chevy Chase in Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Chevy Chase and John Carpenter. Just FYI, before you even think about seeing it, they don't mesh together very well. They're just two different people from two different
They're like ships in the night.
Yeah, Barry Manilow. moving forward with that. In the Mouth of Madness was written by Michael DeLuca, who's got a little bit of a resume behind him. He was responsible for the writing on a lot of the episodes of the syndicated television series Freddy's Nightmares. You a fan of that one, Joel?
You know, I've only seen a few episodes, but I've enjoyed what I've seen. It's definitely not on the level of, like, Tales from the Dark Side or Tales from the Crypt as far as 80s anthologies go. But, it's a fun little show.
Yeah. Definitely one that I remember finding really late at night on a Saturday night in syndication. You know, this was during a time when TV networks would actually sign off at, like, 2 in the morning. And Freddy's Nightmares was like the last thing that they would show. So kind of cool. He also wrote the final entry in the Freddy Krueger saga, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. He was responsible for that debacle.
Well, to be totally fair, there were multiple scripts for that movie. I mean, some of which had better elements, some which had worse. Some of them continued on with Alice and Jacob from, Dream Master and Dream Child.
Yeah.
So, you know, that one had a fairly troubled production in terms of finding the right concept. And then, I think the story is ultimately credited to its director, Rachel Talalay, who was involved in a number of Nightmare on Elm Street films. I mean, Freddy's Dead is terrible. We have a couple of interesting moments, but yeah, it's. I don't totally blame Michael DeLuca for it when its director also gave us Ghost in the Machine and Tank Girl.
Yeah, there's always something in somebody's resume that might get them a lifetime pass. I don't know, but DeLuca.
Well, I met as like. Three failures in a row is pretty impressive.
DeLuca is also responsible for the Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd, which is probably a movie we need to get to on this show at some point.
Why? Why does anybody need to get to that Judge Dredd?
I don't know, because we need to talk about Rob Schneider more.
The film that had the bravery to look at the Judge Dredd concept and say, you know, this needs Rob Schneider.
Since then, of course, Michael DeLuca has gone on to be the producer, executive, or otherwise, behind a lot of stuff, a ton of stuff, even some Academy Award-nominated films, but even some Razzie Award-nominated films, like 50 Shades of Grey.
See, you lead off with that, and you're just being unfair to the guy. The guy also is the producer for Social Network, Moneyball, and Captain Phillips. Grant, I haven't seen any of them, but they're all Academy Award nominees for Best Picture. There's probably some value to those.
But 50 Shades of Grey trumps all of that.
Yeah. Making money, I'm sure the dude was just looked at that and said, we could make money. Now, I think, to be fair to Michael DeLuca, I think one of the things we're talking about here is he was incredibly involved with New Line in the 90s, so his stamp as executive producer is on, like, everything they made, like, in the 90s, for good and bad. I mean, he's on Boogie Nights, he's on Blade, he's on, you know, and into the 2000s, he's, like, with them. He's doing a ton of stuff with them, but he's on the Mask, the 94 Jim Carrey Mask. He's on Dark City, Pleasantville, American History X. I mean, all films that have a certain Magnolia, all films that have, like, you know, a certain level of respect from a lot of audiences. And on, you know, he's on Total Shit, like Lost in Space, like, and John Q, which I already made fun of this episode, but I'm gonna take another shot at. But it's remarkable looking at his filmography as a producer and executive producer, how many successful films he has, whatever you could say about their quality, and not many of them are quality and award nominees. Yeah. And, you know, there's some disasters in there, too. I mean, he was one of the executive producers for Town and Country, which is one of the most fascinating, troubled productions of all time, mostly because Warren Beatty is either insane or an asshole or both.
Yeah, a little both.
Probably a little both.
Yeah. And I just really think, you know, since we're on the topic of Michael DeLuca, I'm sure his bank account helps him sleep well at night.
We should say he at one point was the president of production at New Line and the president of production at DreamWorks, not at the same time, of course, but you know, Bob Shea, one of the founders of New Line, was a mentor of his, so he's got an interesting career. Started out in horror and you know, heavily involved in Star Trek Voyager, so started out in genre stuff, and then moved on to a lot of extremely successful stuff for New Line, DreamWorks. I worked with Sony.
Yeah.
You know, he's actually like one of the least known major success stories in modern film, which is interesting.
Yeah, he's got an interesting backstory, so.
I mean, New Line had a pretty amazing 1990s, and he was, like, instrumental there, which just pretty remarkable history there.
Yeah. And so we've got this guy penning the screenplay for In the Mouth of Madness. So that's quite an interesting little side journey there into one man's journey through Hollywood. He's been on many different levels, and it's interesting to see that. Well, let's talk about the concept of the story here, Joel, for the film. We've got Sam Neill as your star. He's an insurance fraud investigator, and he's assigned to find a missing writer named Sutter Kane. Of course, the head of the publishing company that hires him, Arcane Publishing, the head is Charlton Heston. I love Charlton Heston, and he's usually pretty good in everything he's in. I just wish that I could have more quotable lines from him from this movie, because it's not like Planet of the Apes with "Get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape," or "You maniacs, you blew it up," or "How Soylent Green is made out of people."
But, yeah, no, I mean, he does not have a very, like, over-the-top, role here. It's actually, not to digress too much, but I've always been wondering about his casting here. It almost feels like he's here to give us, like, almost a baseline realism, like, all right, Charlton Heston's here, we're safe.
Yeah. I know Charlton Heston's here. This is a pretty damn big deal, so you better fucking pay attention.
Yeah, that too. he's got his guns. The apes are dead. We're all safe. Like, I guess that's why he's here.
He protected us from the damn dirty apes. That can go in so many directions, dude. I'm gonna stop right there.
Oh my god. Well, at least we got a bunch of new alt-right fans out of that.
So we digressed, and I apologize. Charlton Heston plays the publishing head that hires Sam Neill to find the missing Sutter Kane, because he's got a new book out that is getting all kinds of hype, but nobody's read it yet. In the Mouth of Madness, the title of the film, is the name of Sutter Kane's new novel, and apparently... we learned that Sutter Kane's works have had a tendency to drive those with a less stable mind insane. One of my favorite scenes in this movie, Joel, you might agree, when Sam Neill and Bernie Casey are having lunch in a restaurant.
Yes, I knew that was coming.
And then in the background, you can see a man with an axe slowly approaching the window that they're sitting in front of. And I really, for me, that was probably the best scene in the whole movie. And He smashes the window with the axe, of course, and it turns out that the man is formerly Sutter Kane's agent, gone insane.
Yeah, that's exactly the moment, like, that seems the moment where we know nothing is safe in this film, and it works so well.
Yeah.
Because we've got that great moment where he's just, you know, we see him coming across the street.
People are running from him.
Yeah, people are running. He doesn't even seem to notice. He's, like, laser-focused on Sam Neill. Well, Sam Neill and Bernie Casey are talking about how awesome Sam Neill is. Like, seriously, it's, like, 2 minutes of saying, oh, you're the best investigator I've ever seen. It might as well be, like, 2 minutes. Oh, Sam Neill, your dick is so huge. Which is probably true. Don't get me wrong. Sam Neill's amazing. But, no, it's like, the dialogue doesn't even matter because we're just, like,
We're watching the guy approach the window,
and we're just wondering, like, what's going to happen? I mean, obviously, he's got an axe. He's not here because he, like, wants a hug. But it's just like that moment where he's just, like, standing there, wide eyed, breathing heavily, right outside the window, and they don't even notice him yet. Like, and you're just that moment of just that. It's a moment of perfect tension.
It is.
It's just so well done.
Yeah, it is. I've got more to say about that later, but like I said, my favorite scene in the movie. As we move ahead, though, Sam Neill's character gets hooked up with the book editor. Her name is Linda Stiles, played by Julie Carmen. And they decide to head out on a trip, and they're going to search for Sutter Kane. I guess Sam Neill pieces it together through the covers of Sutter Kane's novels. He pieces together a map of probably where Sutter Kane is to be located. And it turns out that it's in a small New England community. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Much like Stephen King and his Derry, Maine, or Castle Rock, I guess.
But we'll get even more into this, but I think even more so because it's called Hobbs End. Which is one of the names of his books. One of his books is The Hobbs End Horror, which is a direct reference to H.P. Lovecraft's Dunwich Horror.
That's right, and we see a lot of that. That's actually a good side note. There is that there's a lot of paying tribute to Lovecraft in The Mouth of Madness, starting with the title, of course, because In the Mouth of Madness is very similar to a Lovecraft work called At the Mountains of Madness. And so in the movie, Sutter Kane's novels, the titles of them ring very similar to a lot of Lovecraft's works. And the theme also, you know, lends itself to a lot of Lovecraft as well.
Absolutely. For those of our listeners who might remember or haven't heard this one yet, we did an H.P. Lovecraft episode some time ago on H.P. Lovecraft adaptations, and In the Mouth of Madness is not a Lovecraft adaptation, but it's a perfect adaptation of Lovecraft's style. It reminds me of this time, I think it must have been Behind the Music years ago, where Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo was saying that Weird Al's Dare to Be Stupid shamed him because he made a better Devo song than Devo ever did.
Yeah.
And it's like this. No one has made a Lovecraft adaptation as accurate with that level of cosmic horror and you know distorted reality as Carpenter did with In the Mouth of Madness. And of course, you know, we mentioned Stephen King because when you look at the Sutter Kane novels in this, the props, which by the way they went to the trouble of not only doing cover art for all these books, but full plot synopses on the back of the books, which is just phenomenal detail.
Yeah.
Like the cover art design, the font, and the painting style. It's mentioned earlier Paperbacks from Hell. It's very like classic 70s, 80s horror paperback, but yeah, it's mostly reminiscent of Stephen King and of the style of his book covers. I think that's probably because, you know, for a mass audience, horror novels are Stephen King, so it's gonna increase that level of uncertainty, that level of reality blurring, if they're seeing something that's so close to something they've probably held in their hands at one point. But the novel titles are very H.P. Lovecraft. I mean, there's The Whisper in the Dark, which is a reference to Lovecraft's The Whisper in Darkness. There's Haunter Out of Time, which is a reference to The Horror of the Dark and The Shadow Out of Time. Like, it's very H.P. Lovecraft. It's very H.P. Lovecraft, which is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. One of the concepts of the plot, of course, is that the story, the main story, is being told in flashback, because we get the bookend at the beginning of the film of Sam Neill being brought into the mental institution, and then he's approached by David Warner, who wants to, he wants to help him get out. And so Sam Neill is telling his story in flashback. And flashback was a favorite concept that Lovecraft also used in his stories.
Oh, yeah, because so many of Lovecraft's stories are told in flashback or told, like, in epistolary style. You know, someone gets sent letters from a colleague or friend that are becoming increasingly, you know, strange and psychotic and troubled, and they're worried about their friend, and then they go investigate it. Or, you know, you find a journal of someone who, of a colleague or a famous scientist, a famous historian or teacher that's disappeared. And yeah, a lot of Lovecraft is told with these kind of framing devices. And whenever you need a dignified scientist or doctor for a flashback framing device, you get David Warner.
Yeah, that's a point I was about to make as well. So that's a very good one. Absolutely. And of course, so once the story moves, of course, to Hobbs End, that's when, you know, some weird shit starts happening. And for me, I'm going to break down into a criticism of the plot here from Uncle Joel. For me, once things move to Hobbs End, it kind of becomes almost like a haunted house kind of story. It's just basically Sam Neill being bombarded with frightening images that jump out at him from off screen. And it kind of, I mean, the plot has potential. I mean, you've got readers who go in, you've got people who read Sutter Kane's books and go insane. That wasn't really developed, I guess, to my satisfaction. That could have been developed a little bit more. Or, you know, we could have had Charlton Heston, who probably would have had more sinister motives maybe behind him, that like kind of like sinister corporate motives or something like that. That had possibilities there, but basically, for me, In the Mouth of Madness just devolved kind of like into a movie where just shit jumps out at you from off screen.
No, that's an absolutely fair criticism. I find it hard to really argue with that, as much as I enjoy this movie, because it is a very haunted house movie. For like a lot of the more interesting parts, once he's in the Hobbs End, or when he's having like when he's doing like that confessional discussion with Sutter Kane, who's of Jürgen Prochnow from Das Boot. And this is a film filled with cool, interesting actors and side performances. I mean, you've got John Glover here. Of course, we've got. See, the thing is, a lot of our best, like, side actors or most known side actors are in the unambiguous real world. So it's like they're people we trust in the place where we trust them, which I think may be a little bit of a mistake. I mean, it's like, you know, that's where we find Bernie Casey. That's where we find Charlton Heston. Like, we trust them, and they don't really do anything to sort of, break or dissuade that trust. They're just there to give us a sort of real life grounding. And that's almost a shame, because like having things in the real world be a little bit more, it really just does seem like specifically an assault on the real world from Sutter Kane's world. And having it be a little more blurred would be really nice, because there's definitely a hard line between the two for most of the movie.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with that idea as well. It's just I don't know. It's like sending Sam Neill on a bit of a roller coaster ride with just stuff jumping out at him. It just seems like the story probably could have been developed a little better than that. Even the character of Sutter Kane, I don't know. It's just he wasn't, and that character wasn't really developed to my satisfaction either. I mean, there was so much potential with him as well, probably being this this crazy cult leader influencing people through his writings. You know, that they could have gone in that direction with that. And I don't know. I think didn't really fully develop, I guess, to something that I wanted to see.
No, that seems accurate, because Kane, like, more than a cult leader, is just sort of this singular figure who's writing itself, and the power, like, the people in the real world have invested in it, has, you know, sort of opened a gateway for these very Lovecraftian creatures to come through, and you know, he sort of has complete control over this situation because most of the time you're in his world and he's writing all of this. So he gets to be playful. He gets to like stick Sam Neill in time loops or like toss him through tunnels, like chase him with weird monsters. But yeah, a lot of it is just like, it does seem like you'd almost want more of a Wicker Man kind of situation. Where, as weird as this world is that Sam Neill's in, like, you'd almost want more of a slow burn and Sutter Kane seeming affable. Like, if you, you know, go with this, maybe just as an idea, if you have the Sutter Kane disappearance story, he finds Sutter Kane in this weird, obscure little town, and the town seems fairly normal, and Sutter Kane's very sort of gregarious, but things are just a little off, and Sutter Kane doesn't want to go back, but the whole thing is he's basically leading Sam Neill on this sort of weird shaggy dog chase, like just drawing him in by being mysterious, and then at the end, like, then you hit with the twist that, yeah, like, he's the one creating all this, right, or whatever you want to do. Just like, if it seems like a more real world thing throughout until the end. Yeah. Like I think that works a little better, because it's so clear early on, like, even though Sam Neill is very skeptical, like, you get all this like weird time distortion, you get, and time looping, you get like, you get like, oh, so we've been driving through the night, suddenly it's day when we're in Hobbs End. Like,
yeah,
you know, things like that. Like Linda is pretty much kind of an early sacrificial lamb. She goes, like, she gets driven very visibly insane, and like, you know, dealing with Kane. That's a fairly early scene for that to be happening. I almost feel like a more slow burn on that, where Linda is just seeming a little off and he's not sure he could trust her, but maybe she's just kind of freaked out by the situation. Like, more subtlety would have been really useful here.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And you mentioned the time loops, of course, and that harkens back to our discussion about Happy Death Day. And and that's what's really, you know, tying the two movies together that we're talking about today. And, I know that you wanted to touch on, like, the time loop stuff a little bit more in the Happy Death Day talk. So, I mean, now's your chance, man. I mean, you had some ideas there.
Yeah, because when we talked about, for our listeners, when we talked about looking at Happy Death Day this week, yeah, you know, we were talking about other films that have a sort of a reality bending or time loop element to them. In The Mouth of Madness came up, The Beyond came up, House at the End of Time, which I haven't seen yet, I'm really curious about that one, came up. Even Nightmare on Elm Street 4 is probably a pretty close comparison, because Alice and Dan both, if I recall, get stuck in a time loop together by Freddy that they have to break out of when she's trying to save some of her friends.
Yeah.
And also, I should note that in Happy Death Day, they seem pretty openly indebted to Nightmare 4, because Alice's famous lock and load montage, as TV Tropes calls it, you know, getting ready to kick Freddy's ass, gets a very close repeat in Happy Death Day when she's finally figured out who the killer is and she's ready to take the killer on. It gets a very direct tribute. So it's something that I wish horror movies dealt with more, like that sort of almost leaning on the fourth wall, bending reality thing, which in The Mouth of Madness at various points does very well, especially when it starts breaking down the fourth wall, because the whole point is that, like, this in The Mouth of Madness is all, like, you know, it's not only the book that Sutter Kane's writing that's going to lead to everyone going crazy. There's a movie adaptation. And, the sort of, like, punchline horror is, that's the movie you've been watching all this time.
Yeah.
Like, they're really playing with that, like, you know, breakdown between the audience and the actors on screen, which I love to see. Like, I love stuff in horror movies that's, like, recursive and makes you question reality. Like, or, you know, of course, there's stuff that might be a little more psychologically oriented, like Jacob's Ladder is a film we discussed talking about. But I like that sort of metaphysical cosmic horror stuff best, like, you know, which is why I keep coming back to In the Mouth of Madness, even for all its flaws and how it handles its buildup. I really love it. Like, The Beyond is similarly, unsubtle, because ultimately it is, like, an Italian horror film, so you need your big, like, blood scenes, you need your big gory deaths. But, you know, the end is so bleak and strange, and, you know, Fulci has that weird, like, dreamlike sensibility to him that, like, lulls you in and then spreads out where everything is covered with this unreality, which is why I love The Beyond so much. In the Mouth of Madness, I wish did more. I'd almost compare it more, if we're talking about Italian directors, to, like, Suspiria or a similar, like, or Inferno, like one of Argento's very grandiose films, because that has this element to it.
Oh, yeah. So I recently watched and reviewed Suspiria for Retro Movie Nerd, and y'all go check it out. It's there in my archives. But anyway, yeah, very bombastic in its visuals and whatnot, and a little lacking in story somewhat. But and that's what In the Mouth of Madness is, really. John Carpenter's got a lot of finesse here with his visuals, even though the story had potential to be something a little bit more than it actually was. Another thing I wanted to touch on real quick. Of course, you know John Carpenter likes to score his own films. The rock score. I appreciate it, because, you know, I'm a fan of rock music, and I know Carpenter is a good composer, but in the beginning of the film, you know, we're at the sanitarium, and we've got rock music blaring on the score. It just didn't seem to fit. It seemed out of place.
I would almost assume that was sort of pushed on them by, pushed on Carpenter by New Line, maybe, because it feels like a very weird choice, and it doesn't feel like, aside from, like, goofy jokes, like Sam Neill being upset in the asylum because, like, they're playing We've Only Just Begun by the Carpenters.
No, not the Carpenters.
Which... I'm just gonna I'm gonna revoke my horror cred. I think, like, Richard can, you know, go pound salt or whatever. Karen Carpenter is phenomenal. I love her. And We've Only Just Begun was written by Paul Williams, goddammit.
Yeah, Paul Williams. The, you know, Swan from Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah.
I was going to say that I think that kind of set the tone for the movie as well, because it was kind of like a black comedy, I think, in the beginning, really.
And which is weird, with
that,
because
they bring Neil in, and he kicks the nurse in the balls, and he, as they taking him to his padded cell, he's like, "Sorry about the balls."
Balls. It's a very weird tonal opening. Like, the opening track, was the opening track, I'm trying to remember, was it Enter Sandman or was it an Enter Sandman sound alike?
So what was that? Enter Sandman and what?
And then was it Enter Sandman, or was it just a song that sounds suspiciously like Enter Sandman?
I think it was a Carpenter original, but yeah, I did hear a little bit of Enter Sandman in that. I think you're right.
Everything about the opening is weird, and it sort of conflicts with the rest of the film. I mean, there's some dark comedy throughout the film, like, you know, Sam Neill, like, later on when he's going through, like, you know, the madder stages of the film, like, brings a lot of dark comedy himself, which, you know, he's very good at doing. But, like, yeah, no, for most of the film is pretty sober about its horror. Like, the opening is and some of the scenes, even some of the better scenes, like, have a little bit of, like, what we talked about, the restaurant scene with the axe-wielding maniac right outside, like, that's funny, it's frightening as hell. But yeah, the opening is so weird. It just does not seem to fit. It's got that, like, surreal one-point composition to the photography down the hallway, like Stanley Kubrick or someone would do.
Yeah.
So the hallway seems like so out, like, forever. But yeah, he's like headbutting and kicking the orderlies in the balls. I mean, at that point, you might as well hire the Fat Boys to be the orderlies.
Oh, good throwback there.
Disorderlies, baby.
Hey, and Hayden Christensen sighting.
Yeah.
Got, you know, I know Hayden Christensen. The internet hates him, so we got to bring him up. he just has a brief scene as a paperboy in this film, but whenever Hayden Christensen appears in a movie that we talk about, I got to mention it because I'm just trolling.
And here's the thing, like, I obviously it's like such a minor moment because he's just a kid. Hayden Christensen, I'm sorry, he is not that bad in the Star Wars prequels. He gets stuck with the worst dialogue, which I think is what people aren't getting. Natalie Portman is much worse than him. I'm sorry, like, she has nothing going on in those performances, and she has an Oscar now. Hayden Christensen, like, I'm not saying he was great, but he does what he can, and he actually, like, you know, gives some semblance of emotion to his performance, even though some of it could be modulated a bit better. But, like, no, he just gets stuck with the worst dialogue and the worst character arc. That's the problem here.
Yeah, I think even before Revenge of the Sith came out, I think Attack of the Clones probably killed his career.
Oh my God, yeah.
Well, I guess as we've been discussing, I'm not a huge fan of this film, Joel. This is going to be my recommendation. You know, it had potential. There's a few different directions you could have taken the story. The one we got, to me, was a little disappointing, as it just ended up being, you know, creepy stuff jumping out of the shadows. Which has been done. And I did enjoy some of the visuals, and like I said, my favorite scene in the film was the restaurant scene. But ultimately, I would take a pass on In the Mouth of Madness. Not Carpenter's weakest film, but definitely something that, in my opinion, is not as notable as his earlier work in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, I would not say take a pass. I think, like, even beyond being a Carpenter completist, I think it's a worthy film. Partly because you have some interesting cinematography from Gary Kibbe, I don't know how to say his name. I'm so bad at pronunciation, dude. But but he also did Prince of Darkness and They Live with Carpenter and Body Bags. Basically, he just kept working with Carpenter through like all the late 80s through the whole 90s after Dean Cundey did Roger Rabbit and moved on to other stuff. And he's a very different cinematographer than Dean Cundey. I often wonder what this film would be like with, like, Cundey on here, because his stuff is so, like, there's, like, a lot of very almost portrait-like compositions in this, which I guess probably works best for the style, because it's already, if you're already comparing everything you see in your head to, like, the paintings on the Sutter Kane novels. So echoing that in the cinematography, especially in the surreal scenes, I think probably is the way to go and a smart decision. But I often wonder, like, in my, like, you know, my fantasy in the Mouth of Madness with the more subtle plot, like what Dean Cundey would have done with his very naturalistic sort of Halloweenish like cinematography in that plot. It's not a perfect film, obviously. It's a film where it does become kind of a haunted house gauntlet of shit going crazy, which is fun. Like, in a certain mood, it's like just watching it for that pure like sensation of, oh, what weird thing is coming next is really fun. I think if had you gone more Wicker Man with this, it probably would have been a more successful film. I do think, like I said, it is Carpenter's last great film, and people will argue about how great it is, but I think it's the last Carpenter film that really feels like a real Carpenter creation.
Okay, very good. Well, there you have it. Happy Death Day, a resounding recommendation in the Mouth of Madness. We're a little split on that, but it's probably something that has, a little bit of something that for everyone, whether it's, creepy images or John Carpenter's usual special effects work. So, check it out.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, it's a polarizing film for a reason, but so it's one of those films I have no trouble recommending, because it's one where everyone sort of forms their own opinion on it. I will say that, like, I can unambiguously say that the soundtrack is weak, and that's weird for a Carpenter film.
Yeah, definitely not some of his strongest scoring work there, compared to other films, for sure.
And it doesn't even fit in the style, which is great. Like, if you wanted to, like, generic sound alike rock stuff, like, that would have been fine in Ghosts of Mars or Vampires.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. So there you have it. Happy Death Day and In the Mouth of Madness. Hang on a second, Joel. I got it. You ready?
Yep.
What's the time for?
A 30s cartoon?
That's the Stump Joel theme music.
Cuphead? Are we playing Cuphead?
Cuphead. That was my attempt at 60s game show music.
Actually, no, I can hear that now. That does work really well.
Yeah, let me see if I can find something in post production to cover up my embarrassment.
No, keep it. Works fine.
Yeah, it's time for Stump Joel, that segment of the show where I throw a bunch of questions at Joel and see if test his knowledge and see how smart he really is when it comes to movies. And so far, he's done pretty good. Joel, you're average. You're generally right on the money, around 4 out of 5. You've been 5 out of 5 a couple of times. So you know your shit, man.
So I'll try.
I've developed a theme for this round. It's holiday slashers. I know, Joel, you're a fan of slashers, and I know you're definitely a fan of holiday-themed slashers. And who isn't, really? And
Siskel and Ebert.
Oh yeah, they hated them. Oh yeah, they had plenty of stuff to say about one of the movies that I devised a question from.
I have a feeling I know which one that is.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll save that one for last. So I'm going to so holiday themed slashers is your category, and five questions, and no pressure, no time, just answer whenever it comes to you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Movie number one. Question number one. My Bloody Valentine.
Woo.
Its star, Neil Affleck, who plays the character Axel, is maybe probably better known as the sometime writer and director of which long-standing television series?
Oh, Neil works on The Simpsons, right?
That is correct. Ding, 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 ding. He's also animated many episodes. I didn't want to say that, though, because that would probably give it away.
Give it away, yeah.
So, yes, Neil Affleck. Longtime member of the creative force behind The Simpsons. I'm not sure so much lately, but I think up until about maybe 2007, he was he had his hands pretty deep in The Simpsons.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he worked on the Simpsons
movie. Yes, for sure, that is correct. But so that is an interesting career turn for a young actor who I guess work dried up for him, and he decided to try his hand at animation. Very good. You got that one. Let's move on. April Fool's Day. April Fool's Day is one of three films that came out in 1986 that took place on April Fool's Day. Can you name the other two?
Ooh, interesting. Give me a second. Let me think.
Also, I got to mention real quick while you're thinking that Muffy and Buffy are absolutely perfect names for slasher films.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, my God. Oh, what a movie. God. Movies in 86 and April Fool's Day. Yeah. I guess we can...
I have a feeling you've probably seen one of these. Maybe you won't get the other. I'm not sure. But you could surprise
Just being probably count out Aliens. Let me think. Yeah, I like that one too. All right. I'm gonna guess one is. I just watched Night of the Creeps, and I kind of want to guess that, but it can't be because it was Pledge Week. That's way too early. Slaughter High is probably an April Fool's Day.
Slaughter High is one, yes, sir. That is correct.
All right, so wouldn't it be Night of the
Creeps? I think the other one is probably a little bit more obscure.
Let me see. I'm going to go with... Because I'm thinking of my, 86 horror films. I don't think it's Spookies, because I don't think they ever gave a date to that. I'm going to guess Killer Park.
Correct. Yes, you did get it.
Yes!
Son of a bitch. Killer Party, Slaughter High, April Fool's Day. April Fool's Day was a popular slasher theme in 1986. Very good.
Wow. I chose Killer Party because it has the word party in it, and it wasn't definitely on another day.
Have you seen Killer Party, by the way?
I've seen it, don't worry. Wow. Yeah, so I saw it way back in college and loved it, and then was like, I showed it to Roxy 2 years ago because I was like, oh, this is such a fun movie, you gotta see it. Then I realized, wow, this movie kind of blows. I still kind of enjoyed it, but it wasn't as good as I remembered.
Well, we'll move on to question number three, and this one's from Halloween. And I know you're a big fan of Halloween, and you're also into the little details. What film is Laurie Strode watching with the kids?
Oh, of course, The Thing from Another World.
Yeah, absolutely. Ding, ding. Of course, John Carpenter would go on to remake The Thing from Another World in 1982 as just The Thing, so a little tie-in there. very interesting.
I got to tell you, we were watching Halloween yesterday. We had movie day with some friends, and I was so excited at like mansplaining that to everyone. Look, it's the thing from another world. Carpenter remade it.
Yeah. Awesome. Hey, I'm glad you just so you were boning up on your trivia. That's why you were watching it.
No, I was watching it because we actually had friends who had never seen Halloween before.
They haven't seen Halloween?
They had never seen Halloween or Night of the Creeps, which we also watched.
Oh my gosh. Where did you dig these people up?
I know. Yeah, I mean, it's gotta be everyone's first time for Halloween at some point.
All right, so, well, you know, Halloween, depending on the age group that your friends reside in, Halloween is considered a quote-unquote old movie. And I know that there will be some young people that avoid quote-unquote old movies.
With their slap bracelets and and their pogs.
Yeah. All right, next question. From the movie Home Sweet Home, a cult favorite.
Which I can't believe I've seen.
Yeah. All right. So the star of Home, well, one of the stars of Home Sweet Home is a man by the name of Jake Steinfeld. And he's gone on to a pretty lofty post-Hollywood career as the founder of what fitness brand?
Oh, it's called Body by Jake, right?
Yes, sir. Ding, 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 ding. Yes, that is correct. Also, it should be noted that he is the founder of the Major League of Lacrosse.
We have one of those?
The MLL. Yes, sir. It's a major. It's a
major. Is that a tax dodge? That's a real thing?
It's a major lacrosse league.
I feel like that's such an egregious misuse of the word major. I should say that aside from that notable thing, he's also Haley Steinfeld's uncle.
Oh, yeah. I did come across that.
Which is weird.
But, you know, we take, I'm sure he takes more pride in being the founder of the MLL.
Or Body by Jake.
Body by Jake has made him millions, so who needs him?
Yes. And I'm sure he takes a lot of pride in being the Coke-fueled star of Home Sweet Home.
I would take more pride in that myself.
Or no, wait, I don't think he did Coke at the start of this one. I mean, in movie, by the way, for our confused listeners. He, like, injects himself with a needle and then goes on a crazy rampage. It's awesome. The movie itself is pretty shit, but it's baffling and it's watching.
And just FYI, for those that didn't know, Home Sweet Home takes place during Thanksgiving. And
Thanksgiving.
And that's why it's in our holiday themed slasher. And finally, last question. And this is the one we hinted at the beginning. We know Siskel and Ebert didn't like this. In fact, Siskel himself went on the show, their review show at the time, went off to name off a bunch of people involved in the production and told them that they should be ashamed of themselves, and they really contributed nothing. And so anyway, just a little hilarious aside. It's Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Woo.
Yeah, we got a question from here. It's more pertaining about the circumstances surrounding the movie rather than the movie itself. But Silent Night, Deadly Night, as we know, had opened to some controversy with a group vehemently protesting the marketing campaign that depicted Santa Claus as a killer. Joel, what was the name given to the protest group?
This is the best thing in the world that I know this for some reason. Well, actually, I think there were a couple different ones, because there was MAM, Mothers Against Movie Madness.
Oh, yeah, they went on to the Phil Donahue show, and I think Donahue created a whole segment of his show around this movie.
Which I'm going to guess was maybe one of the inspirations for the No MAM group in Married with Children.
Yeah.
And there was also CAM, Citizens Against Movie Madness. That's not the, just for mothers yeah. anymore.
And that's the one I'm looking for. Ding, ding, ding. Citizens Against Movie Madness. Oh, man. That actually would make a pretty decent movie title.
I'm surprised Troma didn't get on that.
And this is the 80s. I mean, Movie Madness. I don't know. It sounds like a group that might form in the 50s or something. To
I know, you know, it was never
Citizens Against Reefer Madness.
It was never as widespread in America as it obviously was in the Britain, because we didn't have Mary Whitehouse and we didn't have the Daily Mail. We didn't really have like a crazy conservative outlet like in the 80s, like Fox News Now, where that would have gone nuts over that kind of thing. We just had like all our conservative outlets in the 80s were like totally, you know, normal, well-written and, you know, well-argued sources like the National Review. However you want to argue about their politics, they were like legitimate critique, yeah, rather than like the Daily Mail was. So it never really got big in America. It's weird that Silent Night, Deadly Night ended up being kind of that flashpoint, but people really seem to take like the idea of evil Santa Claus very seriously.
I know. I mean, we had Christmas Evil come out a few years before this one, and no one bothered Christmas Evil.
Yeah, I think it was that poster, which I'm sure must have scared kids, like that Santa arm coming out of the chimney holding the bloody axe or whatever. Like, I'm sure that, like, freaked kids out, which is awesome.
Well, yeah, every kid needs to be freaked out, right? That's how you become a man.
Yeah, that's how you grow up. You get freaked out by weird things, some of which, like, no one understands why you're freaked out by it. Like... That's the great weird thing about being a kid. You could be like, you could love horror movies and be freaked out by like a random weird design of a creature that's meant to be whimsical in a kid's movie.
Yeah, very good, Joel. You nailed all of them, my friend.
Slasher films are where I live.
Yeah. Well, and that's it for the show this week. Very good show, Joel. I appreciate your input as always, and you are the Ayatollah of pop culture, as I bill you at the beginning of the show. And so
maybe just for slashers, I'm sure if like, yeah, I try and keep up with modern pop culture as much as time allows. But I'm sure if you asked me about like what's going on and like, I don't know, whatever shows white people watch these days, Walking Dead, I know what's going on in there for years. Game of Thrones,
Suits.
Suits, is that a thing? Is that a real thing? House of Cards, Orange is the New Black. I'm not even sure people still watch Orange is the New Black. But there's a lot of turnover in serialized drama. I'm happy with my DuckTales reboot.
Again, thanks as always, Joel. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome. And thank you all for listening on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. That's where you can find Go Home in a Box. And check the Place to Be Nation Pop Network on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, wherever else you grab your podcast from. You'll find us there. Until next time, for Joel LaPuma, I'm Chris Jordan. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you.